Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Tickle, leading visionary, top-ranking speaker and advisor on technology, business, competitiveness, globalization, and innovation. David, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Good to be here. Thank you.
David, can you describe what triggered your interest in technology and in business?
Well, you know, I started my my academic career was actually in social sciences, not in technology. And I have a degree in political science and sociology. And then I got involved in the IT industry. And this was way back in the late 70s. And at that time, the industry was very technology focused. And I discovered that there were actually people out there who were trying to figure out a meta-analysis of what's going on in the marketplace. So what happened was I actually discovered this little organization that was just trying to crack the Canadian marketplace in 82, 83. It was called Gartner Group, which you probably have heard of. And I actually hooked up with them to set up their Canadian operation. And it was really thrilling to actually see somebody who was actually trying to understand the broader implications of technology for the marketplace. So it kind of triangulated, kind of social issues, business issues, technology issues, and kind of trying to figure out what's really going on, as opposed to, the latest speeds and feeds, which was kind of the preoccupation of most of the vendors back then.
Well, that's kind of an amazing background, and you're saying Gartner Group. I mean, they're so famous today, so.
Yeah, well, back then they were just knocking on doors. I remember, going to Ottawa and, all the big banks on Bay Street, and they said, "Who's that? Gartner Group? I never heard of them."
Well, you also have some other fairly significant roles, for example, with ITAC and ICTC. I mean, what do you hope to accomplish within those groups?
Well, what really interests me right now is coming back to the issue of social implications of computing. How do we compete as a country globally? And clearly, information technology kind of punches above its weight as a field of endeavor within our economy. You know, our contribution to GDP is about 50% higher than our proportion of the labor force. There are a number of ways in which we're not really taking full advantage of it. On the one hand, Canada, even though it is that disproportionate contribution to GDP, we're underinvesting compared with the U.S. To the tune of about 50%. So that makes us less competitive. And then, the other thing that's happening right now, of course, is that even though a lot of people think that this is a field that in some ways is in decline, in fact, it's growing, and our demand for ICTs is growing in Canada, precisely for that reason, that companies are realizing they need to invest in this area in order to be more competitive, and for a number of other reasons as well. But we're facing a crisis in the labor market where we have all the old fogies like me, retiring or on the eve of retirement, and meanwhile, at the other end of the labor market, we have declining enrollments and people not entering the field, and even people who are in the field dropping out of it. So, that's really my interest, both in ITAC, which, as you know, is the kind of a leading association of vendors and kind of a lobby group for vendors in the ICT industry, and ICTC, the Information and Communications Technology Council, which is a kind of independent government-sponsored organization whose focus is really to ensure alignment between the labor market, what's out there in the marketplace, and the needs of employers. And ICTC is currently tackling this problem head-on. So, and I actually, my at ITAC, I'm a member of the board. I've actually been on the board for, about 12 years now. And ICTC, I chair the expert panel, which drives the research agenda for ICTC. So it gives me an opportunity to really kind of play a role in tackling these challenges. I'm also involved in another new initiative, which was just started by Bell Canada and now has about 60 corporate members, which is focusing specifically on this issue, the Canadian Coalitions for Tomorrow's ICT Skills, and I'm consulting to that initiative as well. So, in a number of ways, I'm kind of deeply embroiled in this challenge.
Well, that's interesting. You're talking about these challenges, and I should mention that ITAC is the Information Technology Association of Canada.
Correct.
And so you're working with ITAC, ICTC, and also this Canadian Coalition for Tomorrow's ICT Skills. So I guess this goes around this whole idea of the labor market, and I know a lot of people seem to be worried about the IT labor market, and some people are worried about jobs disappearing to offshoring and other things, and you already talked about that there's a shortage of workers, possibly through retirements and other areas. What's really going on? Can you get into more detail in this area?
Well, actually, you know, both of those things are happening. Jobs are disappearing because of offshoring. In other words, many companies are moving a lot of ICT jobs to lower-cost economies, and that process continues. But at the same time, even though that is, despite the fact that that is happening, demand for IT workers is actually growing. And you know, in the early part of this decade, we had about 550,000 people working in this field. In ICT occupations of one sort or another. Today it's closer to 600,000, and we anticipate that by the end of the decade it'll be 660,000. So even though we're moving jobs offshore, demand is growing. And it's growing, you know, first of all, for the reason that I said, which is that we've underinvested for a very long time in this area. And secondly, because, you know, companies are using IT in ever more areas of the business. It's becoming pervasive in every aspect of our lives, and it's affecting many, many more things that organizations do. So there's a kind of structural growth in demand due to that ever-increasing need for ICTs. And just to kind of, you know, do a comparison, I mean, in India, which is, you know, a target of a lot of this offshoring, for the past several years, the growth rate has been 40% a year. In terms of employment, and in Canada, it's been much more modest. So, you know, but still, it's growing, and you know, there's a myth out there that you know, this offshoring is creating a decline in jobs, and that's absolutely not the case. But what is happening is that the kinds of people that we need are changing. But we can come to that in a few minutes. But certainly, probably we face this critical issue right now, which is that, even though we're seeing a growth in employment and in opportunities for people in this field, kids are not enrolling in this field right now at the post-secondary level, whether at colleges or in universities. In some places, as much as a 40% decline in post-secondary programs. Also, people in mid-career, particularly women, tend to be dropping out of the field for a variety of reasons. So we're kind of at a point of crisis in this labor market.
So you talk about some underlying factors then, such as decline in enrollments, underrepresentation of women leaving the field. There's the whole area of retirements in general. I guess there's something like almost 3 million Canadians that are within 10 years of median retirement age. All of these are sort of factors, and I guess bad press over the years and so forth. Do you have any other sort of underlying factors behind these changes? And in addition to that, how are the jobs of tomorrow going to change and why?
There's a lot of there are many different points of view on why we're having this problem of declining enrollments, and you know, there's a lot of mythology out there about why this problem exists, and unfortunately, there's actually very little hard data. In other words, if you look across the entire kind of range of developed economies, you know, U.S., Western Europe, Canada, places like Australia, New Zealand. The total number of really good pieces of survey of research, where people have gone out and actually asked kids why they think why they're not being attracted to careers in this field, it's a handful of studies, and most of them are actually pretty, you know, they're not really very impressive. The one study that was done, and there's been none done in Canada that really gets to the bottom of the issue, although currently. At the moment, the Conference Board of Canada has been hired by this coalition that I mentioned to do a big survey of high school students on this issue. So hopefully by this time, you know, next year, we'll have some good data on it, or actually sometime in the winter. So let's get to you know, what do people think, or what are the views, and what did the Australians learn in that? What I think is probably one of the better studies on this topic. I think there's a lot of mythology out there about this issue. A lot of people think that the reason why kids are not enrolling is that because of the dot-com crash 5 years ago. So people think this is a field that's in decline. Or this whole offshoring phenomenon, which people say, well, you know, why should I go into a field where I might not actually be able to get a job? But I actually think that, you know, that may be a bit of a factor. But I don't think it's the central factor. And the Australian survey corroborates that was certainly not the main issue in Australia. Other people think that the reason why kids are not enrolling in this field is because it's sort of an everyday thing now. Computer, you know, imagine if, you know, you're growing up in the 1950s, you know, most people, you know, at that time the hot technologies were cars, they were, you know, home appliances like refrigerators that suddenly everybody was getting. And, you know, it wasn't really considered to be a field that you would necessarily want to go into if you wanted to have a really successful life. So some people think, well, now computers are becoming the everyday technology, so you don't really need to treat it as a field of study or a field for a career because it's so kind of commonplace. Again, I don't really buy that because obviously computers are much more interesting and have a much greater impact on so many dimensions of our lives than cars or dishwashers or refrigerators ever had. So I don't really buy that theory either. But you look at the data that does exist out there, and what you find is that there's a certain perception among young people that IT is not the greatest career choice compared with other fields. There's a perception that you will spend your life sitting in front of a computer screen, that you won't really get to deal with people, that you're, you know, you might make good money initially, but your long-term career prospects won't necessarily be as great as if you went into some other field like marketing or finance or, you know, kind of general management kind of an orientation. So that is what the Australian research turned up. And I kind of expect that we'll get similar kinds of data from the Conference Board study here in Canada. So I think that what this means, let's say I'm wrong. Let's say turns out to be some of these other factors. You still need to make the case to a kid who's making a career choice today that this is a better career choice than one of these other ones, or it's at least as good. Otherwise, you know, it's hard to make the argument. So I think what we need to do, whether this turns out to be the real issue or not, is we need to kind of look at ourselves as an industry or as a field and really ask some hard-nosed questions. Is this really, you know, what's the ROI? What's the return of investment on going into the field of information technology as compared with some of the other options? Let's say you're dealing with a bright kid, you know, who's making the kinds of choices they make early and mid-high school about what they're going to prepare for, and they're thinking, okay, I'm willing to take on something that's hard, because obviously computer science is hard, so I'm going to look at the various hard fields, ones where I need to apply analytical skills, and kind of go through a very complex and demanding field of study. And at the end of it, I would expect to get a great payoff in terms of the kind of career prospects that I would have. So what would some of the alternatives be? Certainly some kind of engineering field, perhaps medicine, maybe accounting, which is fairly analytical, finance, that sort of thing. And you kind of stack those up against one another, and you look at the relative amount of effort involved in going into one of these fields, and then the total combined future payoff. And I think what you discover is that although it's changing right now, and I'll get to that in a minute, because that's really part of the solution, but at the same time, it is true that in terms of today's environment and certainly the legacy of what it's been like to work in this field, it's not that great. Let's face it. I mean, yeah, sure, there are many jobs in IT where you don't just spend your whole life sitting in front of a computer, but there are a lot of jobs where people end up really getting pigeonholed in this field. They tend not to get job rotations into other divisions of the company. Let's say you're working in an IT department, you know, what's your likelihood of getting a marketing assignment for a couple of years, or or a finance assignment for a couple of years. What's your likelihood of becoming the CEO of your company? Practically nil, even if you work in an IT firm. So, the demand is changing, and the career prospects are getting more interesting. But if you look at it objectively in terms of the history of this career choice relative to other options that kids have, it's really arguably not competitive. So we need to look at that factor, and we need to figure out what we're going to do to address it. And it really comes to the second part of your question, which is how are the jobs of tomorrow going to change and why? And you know, it's kind of a fortunate fact that the way that jobs are changing does actually address this problem. And the way they're changing is that we are increasingly needing people who are multidisciplinary. And there's really kind of two kinds of, in broad strokes, two kinds of computer careers that are emerging, or ICT careers that are emerging. On the one hand, we're seeing a growing need for people who have really strong set of things that we, at the ICTC, we refer to as the package, which is business knowledge, strong communication skills, leadership skills, business acumen, project management, knowledge perhaps of a particular industry in some depth. So these are really business people, but who also understand IT, or IT people who really understand business. And it's because of the rise of, on the one hand, of offshoring and outsourcing, and on the other hand, the growing ease of programmability and implementation of so many computer technologies now, that in fact people with those kinds of skill sets can play an ever increasing role in the IT function, and there's a growing need for them, because increasingly now we're finally, you know, remember, I don't know, 5, 10 years ago, 15, 20 years, we always used to fret about alignment of IT and the business, and that was a big topic. Well, today, you know, it's still an issue, but it's far less of an issue, because it's actually now becoming a lot easier to align IT with the business, and a lot of businesses are really starting to understand how to capitalize on IT. And it's because of the growing prevalence of people with that kind of package skill set combined with their IT fluency that's becoming true. And also the fact that the technologies are finally becoming easier to implement, and that's going to just increase as we get into, you know, cloud computing and next generation internet technologies, and user programmability of many applications, and so on and so forth. So that's kind of, so when you think about those kinds of jobs, well, what you're doing is you're creating career opportunities for people who really want to exercise both sides of their brains, not just the analytical side, but also the human side and the kind of creative and interactive side. And, you know, whereas traditionally, you know, the kind of the image of an IT career, the nerdy image of the IT career, was that it was primarily the analytical side. And unfortunately, you know, that actually plays out in terms of a lot of the way a lot of IT departments are being managed and historically been managed. So that's the one. And then on the other side, which is more the analytical side, the analytical collection of jobs, well, that continues to be really important. But also what's happening with that collection of jobs is that a lot of them are also becoming more interesting and more demanding and more creative. Because what's happening now is that they're becoming increasingly integrated they're becoming multidisciplinary in a technical sense. So you've got one half of the jobs that are becoming multidisciplinary, IT and business. And then on the other hand, many, not all, but many of the IT jobs are becoming technically multidisciplinary. So you have the rise of fields like bioinformatics, which combine biotech and IT, or, you know, I don't know, hedge fund design on Bay Street, or, you know, people who are doing, who understand energy and geology technology, and who also understand IT, and who can do work, say, in the oil sands in Alberta. So these are kind of multidisciplinary technical skill. Gaming is another one. You know, you think of gaming as a technology field. Well, it's not just a technology field. You need to understand human behavior and kind of have an artistic orientation and ergonomics, you know, all kinds of things like that, which are both art creative and also technical. So that's what's getting to be really interesting now about even the more pure technical sides of jobs. So what we need to start doing is we need to start telling that story. And also we need to start changing the way we prepare people and manage people into these new kinds of careers. And that's where the opportunity lies.
Well, that's a really, sort of really interesting kind of answer in terms of, where the market is and where the jobs are and sort of what the needs are and how it's changing over time. Previously we talked about declining enrollments. I read one figure that it was something like 36 to 64% decline since 2002.
Yeah, depending on the school. Yeah.
Why did this occur?
Well, as I say, my opinion is, there have been various factors, all the factors that I mentioned, the perception of I think initially it was the dot-com crash, because there was a huge drop and the offshoring phenomenon, which combined, led to a drop in employment. Not so much offshoring in Canada, because we were actually slow off the mark on offshoring, but there was a decline in employment due to the dot-com crash and the whole telecom fiasco of the early part of the decade. So that was kind of an initial factor. But then, subsequent to that, I believe that there's some residual impact of that. But I believe that the main issue is that kids don't think they particularly want to go into this field for the reasons that I said. They don't want to be perceived or have the experience of being nerds who are stuck in front of a computer screen for the rest of their lives, even though that is actually not the future of these jobs. So that's my opinion. But as I say, we don't have the hard data on it quite yet. We're working on it.
Well, it was interesting. I was just talking to Dave O'Leary, and he's the chair of the National Council of IT Deans for the ACCC, which represents all of the colleges and institutes. And I guess he's done sort of an informal study right now that he may release shortly. And he's actually finding, I guess, just this year or maybe late last year, that, and so at least in some institutions now, they're finding enrollments are actually coming up again. So I thought that was good news.
Oh, it is excellent news. Yeah. Well, actually, this is at the college level. Actually, even sort of at the depths of the crisis of the past 5 years or so, some programs in the colleges have remained relatively stable, and those are particularly the ones that are more at the technician level, the electronics technician, the people who, let's say when you take your computer into Best Buy because it's the hardware is broken and you want someone to fix it for you, or someone's going to come to your house and help you set up your home network, or if same kinds of people who work at a business level. Those enrollments have actually not been hurt that much. But it's the real programming. It's the hard stuff and the more complex and esoteric stuff where both the colleges and the university have been hit. So it would be interesting if we do get some data that those programs as well are on the increase now. That would be great.
I guess the other thing, too, you talked about gaming, and it's about a $18 billion marketplace here in North America, whereas movies are only $9 billion, and I don't think people realize that. So it's increasingly a big environment for the youth getting into this whole kind of online gaming, multimedia environment.
Yeah, well, there's a good news and there's a good news and bad news story there too, though, which is that some of the research that I've seen, again, not so much in Canada, but in other countries, when kids are asked those kids who do want to get into computer science are asked, okay, what part of computer science are you interested in? Probably by far the largest segment of them tend to say, I want to become a gaming programmer. So yeah, that's great. It is, it actually is attracting those kids who are seeing that opportunity. But the flip side of it, of course, is that although gaming is a growing marketplace, it's not going to help Bay Street very much if all these kids decide they want to become gaming programmers. I would think that once they kind of enter the field, even if it's for that reason, and then they realize, well, the jobs are somewhere else, well, they've got the training, so maybe they'll go to Bay Street after all.
Well, it's interesting, and you talk about Bay Street, and then, there's those figures from the World Economic Forum or the Economist Intelligence Unit or the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Canada used to lead the world in single digits in terms of various areas of technology, either first, second, third, or fourth place, something like that. Now we're way into the double digits, so I guess it's having this impact. It has to be addressed.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Earlier we also talked about a gender issue. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, well, this is a problem that's been with us for, geez, ever since the beginning of the computer science field, from the very, very early days, 40 or 50 years ago, that women have been grossly underrepresented in terms of as their percentage of the workforce in this field, and it's never really gotten any better. We kind of have stood at around the 25% mark of women in IT for as long back as most people can remember. And of course, if women actually pulled up their numbers to be equal to the number of men in this field, then the whole problem would be solved. We would no longer be in a crisis. But actually, what is happening is that as enrollments are declining across Canada and other, and not just Canada, by the way, this isn't a problem just in Canada, as I was kind of alluding to earlier. It's a problem in all in industrialized countries. But as we're seeing declining enrollments of men in post-secondary programs, we're seeing a commensurate decline in enrollments of women. So women remain at about 20 or 25% of the student population in IT, while the total size of that population declines. So what that says is that there's a broader set of issues here that affect both women and men, and then there are some specific gender issues that affect women. And although there's been little research done, as I said earlier, on why we're seeing this broader decline, there's actually been a ton of research on why women have not kind of pulled their weight in this field. And really, the core issues here are cultural, and it goes to the fact that although women are just as good, girls are just as good as boys in mathematics, let's say in grade 3, 4, 5, 6, they get messages very early on in their childhood that, in fact, you know, math and scientific pursuits and so on are not really girl-type things. They get that from everybody, all the influencers, parents, friends, relatives, aunts and uncles, even their teachers, to some extent their guidance counselors. So they get these messages from everywhere, the media. So that's a discouraging factor. And then the other thing that the research has found is that it's also there's also a kind of anti-women. I mean, it's not directly misogynist, but there's a kind of the culture of IT is not a kind of culture that women would be comfortable in, and both because the affordances, the physical affordances, let's say the washrooms and so on and so forth, things like that are not set up in a way to be female friendly. In fact, in some situations, women do find that kind of a misogynist, anti-women attitudes among people in the field, both among teachers, say college and university teachers, and also employers and co-workers, and also just the whole culture of IT is kind of historically has been this kind of nerdy, inward-looking, non-communicative, relatively non-collaborative kind of work style. But again, if you come back to what I was talking about earlier and the new kinds of demands that we have for the new kind of IT worker who has this package of business and communication skills and who are able to apply the relevance of IT to everyday situations far more readily and more quickly, well, lo and behold, those are precisely the kinds of things that women tend to be better at than men. So it's kind of another case for the fact that we should be able to get that message out there to this segment of the population. But, we'll see if we're successful at it. Right now it's a problem, and if we could solve that problem, we'd be going a long way to solving the bigger problem.
So how does the value proposition then of an IT career rate in comparison to the other career options that are available to young people and to women?
Well, as I say, historically, it hasn't been that great. In fact, I did a survey. I was speaking at a conference a couple of months ago of CIOs, and we had one of these handheld voting systems available to us. So I asked the CIOs, I asked them point blank, well, what's the likelihood that someone in IT, one of your staff, would get job rotations into other departments as compared with people, with their peers in other departments of the company? Very low. Most people said it's much less likely to happen. What's the likelihood of a person with IT credentials becoming the CEO of your company? Well, 33% said it would never happen. And the vast majority said it's highly unlikely. None said it would. None said it was likely. Not one person said it was likely to happen. So when you look at that, and you look at IT companies, IT companies themselves, take out all the companies where the founder is the CEO, and hardly any IT companies or telecom companies have a CEO who actually has whose principal credentials are IT credentials. But most others, if you look around the industry, HP, it's finance guy is the CEO of HP. Bell Canada, the current CEO, George Cope, is a sales guy. He was preceded by a guy with a PhD in philosophy or history or something like that. So, you know, we've got to fix that if we're going to make this an attractive field.
Something that I saw, which I found interesting, was from the Princeton Review, they actually did released a study indicating the median salaries for those with a bachelor's degree only, with less than something like 5 years experience, and then for those from 10 to 20 years experience. And actually, of the 10 top career areas, IT ranked number one as the starting salary, and then it actually ranked number two out of the top 10 jobs with people with 10 to 20 years experience, second to economics. So it started off at 55.9, I guess, as a starting salary, and ended at 95,500 for the ending salary after in the 10 to 20 years area. So I thought that was a pretty good sort of ranking, at least from a money standpoint anyway.
Yeah, and again, coming back to that Australian survey, which, as I say, is one of the few things we have to go on, the kids knew that. The kids recognized that one of the reasons that you might pick an IT career is because the money is good. So they knew that. But that was not enough to get them turned on to the field. Because, after all, a career is more than just more than just money.
Yeah, or that youthography study that came out of Canada, where I guess there is interest in IT, or I should maybe rephrase that, there's actually a high interest in technology. But then if you can kind of get people sort of passionate about it rather than as a tool, right? So
Yeah.
So, you know, we have this immigration scenario here in Canada. I believe we're ranked, second in the world in immigration, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that and if that immigration can solve the problem?
Well, obviously, we have not been able to tap immigration very effectively to fill this gap. And there's a, you know, one of the reasons for that. There are probably two primary reasons. One is that we're not very good at recognizing the credentials of internationally educated professionals, and we need to be more kind of welcoming and better equipped to make those assessments of people's capability and their ability to match the demands of the jobs that are here in Canada. And secondly, our immigration system has not been focused on this challenge, we haven't been doing a very good job of focusing on getting people with the kind of labor market skills that we require. It has tended to be more focused around uniting families. It's been a kind of a generic point system. If you kind of got the number of points, then you got in irrespective of your specific field and so on. Now that's changing, and we are starting to change the way that we make these decisions now, and hopefully that will to some extent solve the problem. But I think it can only take us so far. And the reason for that is because of what I talked about earlier, which is that there are these two different kinds of people that we're increasingly needing. You know, on the one hand, the people with the very strong business skills and the technical skills combined and leadership and so on and so forth. And the second is the strong technical types, some of whom will be IT technical and some of whom will be multidisciplinary. So where immigration can take us only so far, I do believe it can help. But certainly in the first area where we need these people with business and technology, there's a lot of tacit knowledge and, you know, strong communication skills and, you know, kind of contextual awareness, you know, that you can't just kind of turn on by bringing in someone from another country. You know, it takes some history, kind of you need. I mean, there is a kind of set of people now that are emerging in all countries who are becoming these kind of globally aware and globally capable contributors. And those people will be capable of ramping up and functioning effectively very quickly, no matter what country they go to. And certainly if they come to Canada, you know, no matter where they come from in the world and what their background is, they'll come on board pretty quickly and be able to ramp up to do that kind of stuff. But of course, the problem is there's a global competition for that particular set of talent. Everybody wants those people, and there's not enough of them to meet the global demand. So we're fighting with everybody else to get the cream of the crop. So and also on the technical side, you know, those ultra techies that I was talking about, again, you know, where this, you know, the capabilities that are at the highest level, again, there's a global war for talent for those individuals. So, you know, I think that when it comes to people who do more traditional, you know, relatively predictable jobs, you know, immigration will certainly be a piece of the solution. But for these other kinds of jobs and the ones that are really going to make a difference, yes, it can help, and yes, Canada is a great place to live, and a lot of people want to come to this country, but it's not the only choice that people have. So immigration is a part of the solution, but it's not going to get us there. I think at the end of the day, we need to find a way to solve the enrollment problem, because and also to retrain people. I think retraining is also one way to tackle this, and both in terms of taking business people and giving them the IT skills that they need, but also we should be looking at what's happening, let's say, with the automotive industry or, you know, manufacturing industry in general, where we're seeing massive layoffs. And there will be a set of people in these jobs. You know, increasingly, you can't even get a job in a car plant anymore without having a college degree, because those plants are so highly automated. So, you know, it's not, you know, you're not dealing with grease monkeys anymore in a lot of these factories. You're dealing with people who, A, know, have learned, B, have some technical knowledge, and C, know how to acquire it. So we should be doing some targeted programs there, too.
So can you get into more detail, then, on this whole idea of retraining, let's say, of IT workers? I mean, I know many left during the dot-com bust, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and people still leave today. Well, you know, again, it's a matter of getting the message out that there is an opportunity here, that there's a different kind of career. But I think that in order to really, you know, reattract those kinds of people, I mean, you know, those people are kind of jaded and cynical and, you know, a little bit angry about how they were treated, and they came from the old school IT departments, and they don't necessarily have a reason to think that the style of management is changing in those departments, which were driven by cost-cutting and a cost-cutting mentality, which doesn't necessarily come from the CIO. It may have came from finance or somewhere else. But, you know, be that as it may, that was the context. So you got to convince those people that, you know, things are changing. And again, you need to do it for real. I mean, this isn't just about a marketing story. We need to look at the way we're actually running our IT departments and think about how we need to run them differently so that people do have those opportunities to have job rotations and to engage in more creative interpersonal activities and to really make an impact on the business and to see how that impact is working and to have, you know, career prospects that will take them through IT into leadership roles and also potentially into leadership roles in other parts of the business. So if we actually focus on that within our firms among employers, then we'll be much more likely to be able to bring people back. And also, we'll be able to make a stronger case to the kids.
So this actually talks about this whole idea, then, of changing the work environment, and you kind of alluded to this, to try to attract, you know, those people who have sort of left the field and to get them back in. I guess that would also apply to Generation Y or Millennials, the group born post-1980, you know, their attitudes are perhaps different, right, more entrepreneurial, more into teamwork, collaboration. And will trust their friends perhaps more than they'll trust other sources of information.
Absolutely.
And they typically have a richer user experience with technology outside of work than at work. Do you see trying to address them in some way?
Well, that's, yeah, absolutely. We need to be bringing the kinds of tools that they're used to using into the workplace and make them feel like these tools are for real. And not just that they can, you know, sit at their desk and, you know, play with Facebook all day long and talk to their buddies, you know. I don't think that's really what work is about. I don't think the kids will think that if you're letting them do that, that you're really taking it seriously. I think it's more a matter of, you know, in meaningful and useful and genuine ways, taking Web 2.0 technologies and using them to achieve business objectives and demonstrating that you really get it, that these are useful tools and they can be used to achieve, you know, to enable people collaborate better within the company or between the company and its business partners outside the firm, to enable people to manage information more effectively, get the information they need more easily, to strengthen the power of informal networks within organizations so that they can get things done more effectively, that sort of thing. And, you know, these tools all enable you to do that kind of stuff. You know, wikis to build information about whatever, you know, how to solve customer service problems, or how to, you know, build organizational activities that you know, with kind of certain better defined policies and procedures. So yeah, we need to be doing that, and that demonstrates relevance, and it also comes back to the point of using technology in a way that, you know, demonstrates the linkage between business application, but in a convivial way, and the technology itself. And that'll you know, as we show our kids that we're doing that's another way that we can show that they can make a difference, because it's their knowledge of how these systems work that they can bring to the table.
Well, it's kind of interesting when you have something like the Scotiabank announcing publicly that they're now using, SharePoint services to allow things like blogs and personal profiles and so forth to sharing a best practice. I guess that's a movement in the right direction, and it's coming from the banking industry.
Yeah.
They tend to be very conservative, so.
Yeah, I know. Well, and some companies that are in the business of using these technologies with their customers don't allow their employees to use them, which I can just don't understand.
Well, that's got to have to change, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you talked about the Canadian Coalition and other groups that you're affiliated with. So can you get into more detail of who you see as the key players who need to fix this problem and what they should be doing about it? And are we seeing any signs of progress right now?
Well, you know, it's not so much the organizations as it is the players out there, you know, in the real world that really ultimately are critical for this. And all these organizations that I talked about, you know, all that they're doing is they're trying to get the real players mobilized to take action. So, you know, who are they? Well, first of all, they're employers who really need to change, who need to clean up their act in terms of the way that they're. Well, let me come at it the other way, actually. Okay, so there's a knee-jerk reaction which you see over and over and over again as people try to solve this problem, which is that they say, okay, we got to get the message out to the kids. We got to do some marketing. We got to set up a website. We got to tell them this is a great career that they should get into. And oh, you know what? We're going to make it really relevant. We're going to use social networking, and we're going to make it really fun and interesting, and we're going to talk about how it's going to be relevant and how you're going to get to change the world, you know, by going into this field and so on and so forth, right? So a kid, they see this message and they say, oh, okay, well, maybe I ought to check this out. So they go to a university website and they look at the course catalog that's available for computer science, and geez, they don't recognize any of what they just heard in this marketing material in the way that this university is proposing to teach them to be a computer professional. What they're seeing is very traditional computer science program, which, you know, if you really looked at it carefully, what it's really training you to do is to become a graduate student and a PhD in computer science, or at worst and at best to become kind of an old school computer science professional working in a company. And none of this relevant stuff comes into the picture. You know, they may not even require you to take any social science or business courses throughout your 4 years of undergraduate education. So that's the first disconnect. And then the second disconnect is they talk to their friends and their parents' friends and so on and so forth about, you know, what it's like to work at a big company in the IT function. And they're learning the same thing that we talked about earlier about how people's careers are managed and what it's really like to work in this field. So these are the players that need to, and also their teachers are giving them this story and their guidance counselors are giving them this story. So they're getting this advertising on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, all the other social messages that reflect reality are really in a different place. So those are the key players that all need to change. We need to change the way that we manage people's careers in IT. We need to change the way that we educate people to prepare for this field. And it's not one field; it's many, many, many fields. I mean, bioinformatics is a totally different field from computer security or from game design. You know, these are all very different fields, and they require complete, you know, I mean, there's certain things in common, but the differences are really significant. So it's so we need to be really getting a lot better at communicating those choices and educating people for them. So, and also, then we also need to get the influencers understanding all this and not just the kids themselves. So people like parents, guidance counselors, classroom teachers, and so on and so forth. So these are the people that we ultimately need to change. And, you know, what ICTC and ITAC and the Coalition and others, or many others actually, are trying to do is to find a way to, it's kind of almost like a boil the ocean problem here. But, you know, who knows? Maybe Canada will lead the world if we can get our act together and really get all these players moving more or less in synchrony. And I got to say, I mean, let's be clear. There are a lot of really good initiatives out there already. You know, there's a lot of leadership being demonstrated in this country around this problem. For example, as you said, you know, what's happening at Scotiabank is a good illustration of this, you know, using social networking on the job and presumably other ways that they manage IT. There's a great program at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, which is started by a guy named Jonathan Schaefer, who was chair of the department at the time. He's since moved on to become vice provost of the university. But it's called IT and X. And what it is you can get your university degree in information technology. And basically what you have to do is half of the courses that you take need to be computer science courses. And then the other half of the courses that you take can be in anything you like of your own choosing. You craft your program. So if you want to do computer science and music, you can do it. If you want to do it with biology, you can do it. If you want to do it with healthcare or mathematics or some engineering field, you can do that too. And so to me, that's an illustration of the kind of creativity that we need to see in this country, and obviously we're seeing examples of it. We need to learn from those examples and figure out what worked. You know, to what extent did Jonathan's initiative actually pay off? How did he have to tweak it to make it even better and more effective? And, you know, it's just starting, so we don't know how it's going to work out.
Well, David, I'm going to shift directions towards the end of this interview, and that is, you know, you are this top-ranking international expert and advisor on technology and business and competitiveness, globalization, innovation. So I'm going to shift these last questions towards that end of your international expertise. What would you say are the most important broader business challenges and solutions?
Well, of course, the state of the global economy right now is pretty scary. We've got, what we experience every day is, we don't know if it's really in a global recession or what it is. But we know that things are tough out there. And, I think it's interesting because part of my take on this is that I'm sure you've been aware of all this faddish discussion about collaboration, math collaboration, how that's changing the world, and how IT is, things like Wikipedia and Linux and so on are examples of people kind of coming together and doing wonderful things through the power of information technology. And I think that's true. But I also think that it kind of leaves out this kind of utopian vision of the future. It ignores the fact that, you know, the world faces a lot of problems. And in some respects, they seem to be getting worse. And I would argue that the kind of disaggregation of control that IT... information communications technologies has wrought on markets is part of what is driving the current economic crisis that we see in the world. And let me be specific about this. If you look at the whole mortgage crisis that happened in the U.S., really what happened there was a self-organizing marketplace which used the power of information technology to construct a whole new set of instruments, market instruments, that ultimately drove this need and this capability to basically give mortgages to people who didn't merit getting them, and then to package those mortgages into securities that could be resold to people who believed that they were buying something that was worth something but was actually worthless. And all of that was enabled by human collaboration using email and Blackberries and things like that, as well as very sophisticated software applications that enabled these these so-called assets to be sliced, diced, and repackaged and resold in international markets. So really, what we're seeing is that, you know, there's kind of a two levels of disaggregation that are happening now because of the power of information technology. On the one hand, you know, whereas historically a lot of relationships were managed hierarchically and through fairly controlled ways of doing things, even in the banking system. Today, you know, markets are becoming much more powerful. And then the other thing that's happening is that we're seeing increasingly a shift away from pre-designed and pre-packaged and pre-specified solutions towards emergent solutions, where the participants in the network are the ones who are designing the solutions, the outcomes, almost on the fly. And you combine those two things together, and you can kind of see how those two kind of very broad macro trends, you know, kind of crystallized in these instruments, in these asset-backed securities, which were backed by assets that actually weren't worth anything, asset-backed commercial paper type of instruments, and enabled by ICTs. So we're in a situation now where markets are becoming really dominant. And yeah, it's nice to have all these little fun collaboration things happening on the side, but globally speaking, we're kind of out of control in some respects. And ICT has played no minor part in that shift. So we need to fix that. Then, of course, there's climate change, which is kind of a big problem too. So those I would say are the two big challenges that we need to face at a macro level.
So would you say that this sort of ties in then with what you see as your predictions of the major trends and their opportunities?
Yeah. Oh yeah. The opportunity is to find new ways and more creative ways to manage against these problems. Certainly, climate change. There's big opportunities for any country that can build a new kind of economy that is also that's both more energy efficient and that creates new kinds of technologies that facilitate energy efficiency, because there's going to be huge global demand for those kinds of solutions. And on the other problem, this kind of tyranny of markets that seems to suddenly overcome us all, the opportunity is to fix it so that we can get back to living more predictable lives.
David, you're one of the most connected people out there in the sense of being this worldwide authority. Do you have some recommendations of resources that you use or you recommend to the audience?
Well, I have my own, you know, there's kind of two levels to this. I have my own dashboard, you know, which is on iGoogle, in which I track, you know, what's happening out there and the things that I'm interested in. So I pay close attention to both web-based resources like TechMeme and TechCrunch. I have a set of blogs that I track through Google Reader. And then I also pay very close attention to the major media, not so much the technology media, the business media, how they're tracking technology. So the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, The Economist, those kinds of sources. But I also still read books. And I say that with a bit of a joke, because I don't know if you've been following, of course you're familiar with, I'm sure, with Nicholas Carr and the work he did around IT Doesn't Matter and so on. He did a more recent book called The Switch on the rise of cloud computing, and I just actually finished reading it. And he talks about how and there's actually now a kind of an interesting debate going on the internet about this issue, which he raised through an article that he did in The Atlantic, where he talks about how we're becoming, because of the internet, we've become kind of attention deprived. We've all got this serious case of ADD. And we're just looking for the next hyperlink, and we're finding it increasingly difficult to concentrate on things. And he was describing his own personal experience. So it's ever harder for him to read a book or to go through a lengthy article and read it from end to end. And, you know, I think that we really need to be very at a personal level, and also, again, at a social level, be a lot more reflective about the sort of the cultural impact of technology on our lives and what's really going on, and to adopt a critical perspective rather than just a kind of Pollyanna-ish view that it's everything will always be for the best. We need to look at both sides of the equation. I'm involved with an organization called KINSA, the Kids Internet Safety Alliance, which is focused on the issue of how kids are affected by sexual, you know, things that they encounter on the internet that threaten their personal safety. And of course, this is only one of many challenges that the internet poses to our personal integrity. We need to think about that stuff and not just fall in love with our own tools.
Well, we're at the end of our interview. Do you have any closing comments you want to make?
Well, you know, I think this is a really interesting time to be living. I think anybody who is alive today should consider themselves to be very privileged. On the one hand, it's a kind of a crucial moment in terms of the history of our planet because of some of the huge global issues that I talked about earlier. But on the other hand, it's a period of just tremendous innovation and learning. And in every sphere, in every microsphere, you know, people are carving away at the coalface of innovation, of knowledge creation. So, you know, you look at a field like biotech where, you know, every, you know, individual part of the human cell is itself a subject of innovative research. It's not just the cell anymore. It's not just one piece of the cell, but you know, proteins, genes, you know, various mechanical parts of the cell are subjects of entire domains of innovative research. And you can apply that to just about any field you can imagine. And there's that same, you know, we're kind of at this period of exponential growth of human knowledge. So it's a wonderful time to be alive. Speaking to you from my cottage in northern Ontario, where all I see around me is green. And if we can find places like that to be, so much the better.
That's true. Well, Dave, you know, we thank you for taking the time and for you to share your wisdom and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to do this.